Hello there, and welcome to a brand new series of Cat's Whiskers, the first for the 1990s. And as Paul told you last week, from now on, you're stuck with me. Me being Andy Crane, if we haven't met, a very good evening to you. Thank you for joining us. 1990, a brand new decade. Have you made any New Year's resolutions? I have. I shall tell you what mine is, if only so you can keep check on me, see how I do. I resolved for 1990 to stop biting my fingernails. Again, I didn't last very long last year. Hopefully this year I will do a bit better, because now I'm a Cat's Whiskers presenter, you see. I thought I could really do with some cat's claws. So I shall let you know how I'm going on, honestly, truthfully, throughout the series. New series for 1990 then, and some new things for you to enjoy. If you were a fan of the Kitty Perwell mysteries and her sidekick Dick Dogsbody, then you will enjoy meeting Marlene Marlowe a little later on, and her sidekick Aunt Maud, a completely dotty detective. You'll love it. The Cat's Whiskers Doctor, Dr. Pete Rowan, is off to Nepal very shortly, a very exciting and exotic country. We shall find out what he's got to look forward to a little later on. And we've a brand new serial as well called The Call of the Wild, part one of that five-part serial is a little later on this evening. But it is the first Cat's Whiskers of 1990, and I wonder if you have resolved to keep a diary this year. Well, if you have, good luck with it, but we thought we'd kick off this series of Cat's Whiskers with a mystery history diary.
12th of November, 1027. Dear diary, here's another fine mess my courtiers have got me into. Here I am, sitting on my throne, on a beach, in November, watching the tide rolling. It seemed like a good idea at the time, but then it always does. Goblets of mead in front of a roaring fire, everybody laughing at your jokes and admiring your exploits on the battlefield, and then one of them says, "I bet you could do anything, sire, if you put your mind to it." Oh, goodness, that water looks cold. Oh, well, can't put it off any longer. Tide! I charge thee, turn back! I think there was a slight hesitation there. Yet it comes again. Tide! I command thee, turn back! Turn back, I say! The rat! All over the royal footwear. That's it. I've had enough. The next wave will be up around my knees. This is playing havoc with my chilblains.
Somebody sitting by the seaside trying to stop the tide coming in. Any idea whose diary that might be? Well, then, if you've got it, if you haven't, I'll give you the answer at the end of the programme. Now to some unfinished business from the Christmas programme, that being the answer to the Kitty Perwell mystery, The Big Stink. Well done if you got the answer right. The answer you were looking for was the secret agent Aroma Sweet. She was the Lady Santa Claus with the giant stink bomb, and the clues you were looking for, well, she was a black belt in judo, and she knew Professor Crump's name. Well done if you got it right. Lots of people did, but prizes on the way to these winners. Jonathan Taylor, who lives in Nottingham, prize on the way to you. As are prizes on the way to Helen Ingram, who lives in Haileswowen in the West Midlands. And two people from near Newquay in Cornwall, Katie and Joe Toms. Well done for getting it right. The prizes you will be receiving are this rather beautiful book called The 11th Hour. It's a book by Graham Bass. There it is, with some beautiful pictures in it. You will enjoy that. And an 11th Hour mystery watch to match. Never fear, Perwell and Dogsbody fans. They will be back later on in the series, but they're going to take a short break for now because they're a bit tired after all the detecting they have been doing. We have this week a new detective for you to meet. She's a bit dotty. Her name is Marlene Marlowe, and she's going to investigate the Beast of Puddlethorpe Hall.
My name is Marlowe. Marlene Marlowe. I've got the kind of job where the heat is always on, where the pressure is always high, and where the knives are always out. That's right. I work in the kitchen at the Doner Kebab House. The rest of the time, I'm a private detective, investigating cases such as the Beast of Puddlethorpe Hall. It all started the week after Christmas. I was feeling as flat as a fizzless Pepsi. Christmas itself with Aunt Maud hadn't been so good either.
Happy Christmas, Marlene. Here's your present.
Wow, thank you, Auntie. It's two orange and purple tea cozies.
No, they're not tea cozies, Marlene. They're balaclavas.
I asked for a pair of ballet shoes.
I know, but I couldn't get a pair of ballet shoes, so I got you a pair of ballet clavas instead.
It had been Christmas dinner leftovers every day for a week. I'd had cold carrots and cornflakes, cold sprouts and custard and cold roast potatoes on toast. I peered into the fridge. It was still full of turkey. I decided that a good long soak in a bubble bath was what I needed. I peered into the bath. It was still full of fried carrots, sprouts, and potatoes. There was nothing for it. I'd have to forget about the bubble bath and have a bubble and squeak bath instead. Suddenly, a ringing sound caught my ears. It was coming from the shiny chrome fitting on the side of the bath. There was no doubt about it. It was my phone tap. I picked it up, squeezed the water out my nose, and spoke. Hello?
Hello. Is that the Marquess of Bath?
No, this is the Marlene in the bath.
Oh, good. I have got the right number, then. This is the Right Honourable Harold Arbuthnot Payne, sir.
I knew the Right Honourable Harold Arbuthnot Payne well. He was the biggest Payne in Puddlethorpe.
Miss Marlowe, you must get up here to Puddlethorpe Hall. Quickly.
Why? Are the Pips about to go?
No, it's something... Something terrible has happened.
What? It was a fearful sound. I felt chilled to the bones, and I knew exactly why. The bathwater was getting cold. I jumped out and picked up the few things of the handiest, my rubber duck and a bar of soap. I pulled on my baggy burgundy pants and snapped my fantastically fluorescent braces over my shoulders. Then I slipped into my bright blue blazer, pulled my orange and purple balaclava down over my face, threw myself into my big brown boots, and flung myself downstairs. My flat, number 222 Puddlethorpe Point, is 10 floors down. I leapt into the famous Marlene-mobile. A Porsche purrs like a kitten, a Rolls-Royce hums like a bird, and a Marlene-mobile croaks like a frog with a flu. I keep meaning to get myself something faster, like a pedal car. I drew up outside Puddlethorpe Hall and got out. It was cold, dark, and very wet. Mainly because I'd stepped straight out of the car and into the goldfish pond. I walked up the steps and rang the bell.
Yes?
Marlene Marlowe, private detective.
Actually, she's not here yet. I rang her about a quarter of an hour ago.
No, I am Marlene Marlowe.
You? But you're wearing an orange and purple tea cosy.
Balaclava helmet.
And you're all wet.
Yes, a lot of people say that.
Well, you can't stand there shivering on the doorstep. Why don't you come through to the library?
I don't know. Why don't I come through to the library? In the library, a woman stood, leaning on the old marble fireplace. She wore a long, black, shimmering dress, and rows of bangles jangled down her arms. She was certainly not a librarian.
Oh, who is this person, Harold?
She says she's Marlene Marlowe.
Hello.
Why is she wearing an orange and purple tea cosy?
It's not a tea cosy, it's a balaclava.
There's no need to whisper, Marlene.
Oh, I thought this was the library.
Yes, my private library, not a public library.
Harold, if she's Marlene Marlowe, then I'm Bugs Bunny.
Pleased to meet you, Miss Bunny. I thought I recognised the tea.
You fool. I am Camilla de Courcy, the famous rock star manager and Harold's cousin.
Camilla had obviously got the hump. In fact, she was a one-humped Camilla.
Camilla is in Puddlethorpe promoting the Whiny Kimone concert at El Norman's Nightspot. She's Whiny's manager.
Wow! Could you get her autograph for me, Mr. Courcy?
There it is! It's out there! Oh, help me!
There, Harold. Camilla's here.
But what's out there?
The beast! The beast of Puddlethorpe Hall! I heard it! Howling in the night wind like a creature not of this world.
Nobody knows the exact nature of the legendary beast of Puddlethorpe Hall. It haunted Harold's Victorian ancestors. Now, it's decided to manifest itself again.
Oh, nasty.
You must help me, Miss Marlowe.
Must I?
Don't you usually work with a partner, Miss Marlowe? A large, tough character. The one who used to work as Mike Tyson's minder.
Ah, oh, yes. You mean Aunt Maud? She's busy, actually, producing a pantomime.
Not Puddlethorpe's popular pantomime at the Pier Pavilion.
That's right. They were going to do Puss in Boots, but they ran out of money.
So what are they doing instead?
Puss in Plimsolls. The truth is, Mr. Corsi, that for too long now, Aunt Maud has been cramping my style. I intend to tackle this case on my own.
Ah, good.
Good.
And I suggest we start by trying to track down this beast, whatever it may be.
Whatever you say, Marlene. I say, I may call you Marlene, may I?
Of course.
When you've finished gushing, cousin dear.
Well, it's all a bit scary for a chap.
Stiff upper lip, Harold.
It's my new moustache, actually.
The vast gardens of Puddlethorpe Hall had not been touched for years. Gingerly, we picked our way through overgrown bushes and fallen branches until we came to a small clearing. I listened. Nothing but a wintry quiet. And then... Harold? Camilla? Harold? Camilla? I was alone. I lunged forward, trying desperately to find my way back to the house when... I tripped over something hard and heavy. I put out a trembling hand and felt... stumbled across a body. I felt around the face. It seemed to be sort of bearded and wearing a pointed hat. It was a small face and a small body. No more than a meter long. And it was stone cold. Dead.
So, who or what is the stone-dead body with the bearded face and the pointed hat? Any ideas? And what exactly is the beast of Puddlethorpe Hall, do you think? And why is it haunting Puddlethorpe Hall at all? Well, send your ideas to us at the Cat's Whiskers address, which is coming up after the programme. A little later in Cat's Whiskers, we've part one of our story, The Call of the Wild, but somebody else who is answering The Call of the Wild is our very own Cat's Whiskers doctor, Dr. Pete Rowan, who's off to Nepal soon, aren't you?
That's right, Andy, yeah. I'm going in January.
Why are you going?
Well, I went last year to help set up a clinic in a very remote area of the jungle part of Nepal. Nepal's a very poor country, it's very small, but it's a tremendous place, and one of the reasons it's so interesting is that you go right from the top of the world, right from Everest, right down to the jungle plains near India, and we're going into that western part of Nepal just to have a look at the clinic that we set up last year, see the people that we saw last year, see our patients again, and make sure everything's going well, plus do a bit of exploring and sightseeing.
There aren't many doctors in Nepal, are there, Pete?
There's one for every 96,000 people, which really means that you have to have a good bike to get around your practice there, and you have to bear in mind that most of the doctors are in the capital, Kathmandu. And so where we are in the jungle, where there are no cars or roads or telephones, there really are no doctors at all. The people there, they have to look after themselves if they fall ill.
Can you teach people while you're there things that they can use after you've come back?
We try to, because obviously, often the people don't understand what you're trying to do. And all the expensive medicines in the world don't count for anything against going into the villages, seeing the mums and saying, look, when your children get tummy upsets, all you need is some clean water that you've boiled, mix into it a palmful of sugar and a pinch of salt, mix it all up, and you will have something which will save your child's life. And so really, it's getting to know the people and teaching them very, very simple things like that.
Is there anything you have to deal with in Nepal that you would never come across, say, in this country?
Probably the most unusual case I had last time was I was in my tent about 2 o'clock in one morning in the jungle, and about an hour later somebody rattled on my tent and said, look, a wild bull elephant now has wandered over the border from India and trodden on a man that was asleep in a haystack, actually. I went to see this man, and he was very, very badly injured. He had both legs crushed below the knees. Not only was his life saved, and also his legs saved, which was remarkable, but I believe that he's up and about and walking again, but I'm going to go and see for myself.
How long are you planning to stay?
I'm just going for a couple of weeks. I hope to be taking a Cat's Whiskers recording machine, and as long as we stay upright on the rivers as we raft in and don't rock about too much on the elephants as we wander through the jungle past all the termite hills, then I hope to come back with some recordings.
Well, lovely. Well, we'll look forward to hearing it. Have a great trip.
Thanks, Andy.
And come back safely.
I will.
Thank you, Peter. Now, before we go any further, I must just tell you about this rather amazing device that's over here in the corner of the studio. It's a jukebox. It's called a Perlitzer, and it's got lots of bright lights and buttons on it. Now, the only thing is with this jukebox is that I can't actually pick specific pieces of music. I can give the jukebox an idea of what I want, but it will pick the music for me. Like the music for the birthday list, for example. Now, we've just been talking to Dr. Pete. He's going to Nepal. So if I were to, like, put jungle in here... Hang on a minute. J-U-N-G-L-E. Now, we'll see what that comes out with. Whiskers Club members celebrating a birthday this week are Rebecca Cohen, Gail Ward, Claire McGowan, Matthew Catterall, Perry Bishop and Oliver Woollard. Happy birthday too to Victoria Wilson, Andrew Hassel, Matthew Perry, Megan Pratt, Tara Mounce, William Toomey and Asha Passard. Birthday greetings from us to you, to Tasmin Cox, to Sarah Tubbs, to Jonathan Eady, to Jonathan Clark, to Ruth Cresswell, to Ross McKenzie, Anne Claire Wilton and Bryony Lanham. And finally, celebrating birthdays are Sadie Jones, Elspeth Badger, Rachel Ravelbust, Elizabeth Baldwin, Mark Finney, Rachel Arnold, Caroline Robinson, Sarah Mann, Caroline Dyer, Lisa Hoyland, and last but by no means least, Jacobus Lawson. Now, having mentioned that this machine of mine, the Perlitzer, can pick the music for the birthdays, also this series of Cat's Whiskers, it will pick a winner every week to receive a Cat's Whiskers t-shirt from the list of people celebrating their birthdays. So if I press this button now, it will churn out somebody's membership number. Right, here it comes. 1 4 8 2 9 8. 1 4 8 2 9 8. Let's quickly look down the list. Who's got the t-shirt? Sadie Jones. Congratulations, Sadie, celebrating your birthday tomorrow when you will be 10. Have a lovely day. And you may be interested to know that you celebrate your birthday along with David Bowie, who was born in 1947. So figure out how old he is. Also celebrating a birthday this week are Freddie Starr, Rod Stewart and Michael Aspel. Now time for our serial, The Call of the Wild, set at the time of the Klondike Gold Rush. It's a brilliant story all about a dog. Episode 1 is called Into the Primitive.
Did not read the newspapers, or he would have known that trouble was brewing, not only for himself, but for every strong, warm-coated dog on America's west coast. Buck lived at a fine house in sunny California. Judge Miller's place, it was called. Behind the house, with its cool veranda, wide lawns and tall poplars, were spacious stables and rows of servants' cottages, and beyond lay outhouses, orchards and pastures. Half St. Bernard, half Scottish sheepdog, Buck was Judge Miller's favourite dog. He was escort to the judge's daughters and friend to the judge's grandsons, and on wintry evenings he would lie at the judge's feet before the roaring fire. But Buck was no pampered house dog. He hunted and swam. These and other outdoor delights kept him fit and his muscles hard. Buck did not read the newspapers, but Manuel, one of the gardeners, did. He knew that thousands of men were rushing into the frozen north because in the Klondike Valley gold had been found. These men wanted dogs, heavy dogs with strong muscles and furry coats, dogs just like Buck. One evening, in that gold rush autumn, almost 100 years ago, Buck went for what he imagined was a stroll with Manuel. No one saw them off through the orchard, and only one man saw them arrive at the railway halt.
"You might wrap up the good before you deliver 'em," the stranger said gruffly, and Manuel doubled a piece of rope around Buck's neck. Money clinked between the two men. Buck had accepted the rope quietly, but when it was placed in the stranger's hands,
He growled with displeasure. To his surprise, the rope tightened around his neck, shutting off his breath. In rage, he sprang at the man and his jaws closed on the man's hand. Buck clung on, but the rope tightened mercilessly. His strength faded, and he lost consciousness. The man flung him into a cage-like crate, and when a train pulled up, he was thrown into the luggage van. Next morning began a miserable journey. Always in the crate, Buck was manhandled and transported on carts, trucks, ferry boats, and trains. For 2 days and nights, Buck neither ate nor drank, and a great anger grew in him. Finally, the crate was carried from the cart into a small, high-walled backyard. A stout man in a baggy red sweater came out, smiling grimly. He carried a hatchet and a club. "You ain't going to take him out now?" the cart driver asked. "Sure," the man replied, driving the hatchet into the crate. "Now, you red-eyed devil," he said, at the same time dropping the hatchet and shifting the club to his right hand. Free at last, Buck hurled himself in fury straight at the man. In midair, just as his jaws were about to close, he received a shock that checked his body and brought his teeth clashing together in agony. A dozen times he charged, but every time the club broke the charge and smashed him down. The man struck a final blow, and Buck crumpled up, utterly senseless. "Anxious to the name of Buck," the man read from a note. "Well, Buck, my boy," he went on genially, "be a good dog and all'll go well. Be a bad dog and I'll beat the stuffing out of you. Understand?" As the days went by, other dogs came, and one and all were beaten into submission by the man in the red sweater. Sometimes men came and gave him money and then took one or more dogs away with them. One day, a little wizened man was looking over the dogs. "Sacre dam!" he cried when he saw Buck. "That one damn bully dog, eh? How much?"
"$300 to you, Perrault," said Red Sweater. "And that's dirt cheap."
Perrault grinned. Buck watched money pass between them, and then the French-Canadian led him away. An hour later, from the deck of a cargo steamer, Buck saw the warm Southland for the very last time. Perrault took Buck below to François, a giant of a man, half Indian and half French-Canadian. Here were two other dogs, the big, snow-white Spitz, friendly and treacherous, and Dave, a morose fellow who ate and slept and took interest in nothing. Day and night the ship throbbed to the tireless pulse of the propeller, and the weather steadily grew colder. At last, one morning, the propeller was quiet. François brought the dogs on deck. Buck's feet sank into a white, mushy something, very like mud. He sprang back with a snort. More of this white stuff was falling through the air. He sniffed it curiously, then licked some up on his tongue. It bit like fire, and the next instant was gone. The onlookers laughed. It was Buck's first snow. Hardly had he got used to the feel of snow underfoot when he received a ruder shock. François fastened some straps and buckles on him, harnessed him between Spitz and Dave, and he was set to work hauling a sled.
"Three very good dogs," François told Perrault. "That Buck, him pull like hell. I teach him quick as anything."
Perrault was pleased. As courier for the Canadian government, he had important dispatches to deliver, and he was anxious to secure the best dogs. That afternoon, he returned with two husky brothers, Billy and Joe, and by evening they had been joined by Sol Lex, an old husky with a battle-scarred face and a single eye. Next morning, three more huskies were added to the team, making a total of 9. Before another quarter hour had passed, they were in harness and swinging up the trail toward the Skagway Canyon at the start of the 500-mile trek to Dawson Town. Dave was immediately in front of the sled, then came Buck and Sol Lex. The rest of the team was strung out ahead, single file to the leader, Spitz. Buck was surprised at the eagerness which animated the whole team, especially Dave and Sol Lex. They were utterly transformed by the harness. Buck had been placed between these two so that he might receive instruction. He was an apt scholar and quickly learned how to pull as part of the team. But then there were many things Buck had to learn quickly. To dig himself a snug, warm nest in the snow at night. To bite the compacted ice from between his toes. To break the ice scum on the waterhole and to gobble down his meager daily ration of dried fish before one of his mates robbed him. Not only did he learn by experience, but instincts long dead became alive again. It was as if he remembered back to the time when wild dogs ranged in packs through the primeval forest. Buck became more secretive, more cunning, and when, on the still cold nights, he pointed his nose at a star and howled long and wolf-like, it was his ancestors who howled with him down through the centuries.
And you can find out how Buck adapts to his new life in the frozen north next week in episode 2 of Call of the Wild, which is called The Fight for Leadership. Also next week on Cat's Whiskers, we've part 2 of our Marlene Marlowe mystery, The Beast of Puddlethorpe Hall, and a fast-forward fiction competition. We're going to ask you to write a story. I'm not going to tell you very much this week, except that you could win yourself and your family the chance to visit Disney World. No more than that this week. Join me next week. Ah! I hear you cry. He's forgotten the Kensington Palace competition. Remember Julie and I, when we visited Kensington Palace, asked you to spot 2 fruits, 2 birds, 2 flowers, and 2 fishes? And the correct answers were an orange and a pineapple for the fruits, nightingale and a kingfisher for the birds, or clever people used Wren from Christopher Wren, the bloke who designed Kensington Palace. Well done if you spotted that. The 2 flowers were roses and tulips, and the fishes were goldfish and herring. Or, according to Tessa and Georgina Piggott from Shelford in Nottingham, a whiting. Because Ian Whiting, who is a Cat's Whiskers club member, was celebrating his birthday that week. So well done, Tessa and Georgina, for spotting that. We will send you tickets for your family to visit Kensington Palace. Tickets also on the way to Stephen and Nicholas Todd and their family. They live in Kent, Orpington in Kent. Congratulations to you. And tickets too to Kate Fagan from Purley-on-Thames in Reading. Hope you enjoy your visit to Kensington Palace. And we also asked you, in words and pictures, to tell us what you thought might be behind the secret door. Lots of varied ideas. Sandy Ogilvy, who lives in Carluk in Lanarkshire, has drawn us a picture of what's behind the secret door. Apparently it leads outside. There's a picture of a rather pretty garden with a little river and a bridge and some lovely flowers. So thank you for that, Sandy. We will send you a Kensington Palace pencil case. Alex Strong has a very interesting idea of what might be behind the secret door. Paintings on the wall of kings and queens of the past, painted in all their best clothes when they were crowned at their coronations, and the frames made from pure gold. And on the wall are the signatures of all the kings and queens in their own hand. An autograph hunter's paradise, I'm sure. Thank you, Alex, with a pencil case on the way to you. And finally, Andrew Tiller, who lives in Stourbridge in the West Midlands, says, I think there's a treasure room behind the door with 2 golden cats with emerald eyes on top of treasure chests. And he's drawn us a picture of the cats and the treasure chests. And the treasure has been made of sort of tinsel and glitter. It looks very pretty indeed. Thank you very much indeed for that, Andrew. Well, that's just about it from me this week, except to tell you that the person who was running the Mystery History Diary was, of course, King Canute. Well done if you got that. I'll see you next week at 7 o'clock. Until then, take care. Bye-bye.
Cat's Whiskers address is Cat's Whiskers, BBC, P.O. Box 40, Manchester M61FZ. Cat's Whiskers was presented by Andy Crane. Marlene Marlowe and the Beast of Puddlethorpe Hall was written by Roy Apps. The Call of the Wild by Jack London was abridged by Mick Greenway and read by Bob Peck. Others taking part were Andy Hockley, Anne Rosenfeld, Marlene Sidaway and Charles Simpson. The researcher was Liz Roberts, and the programme was produced in Manchester by Mary Callum-Carrion.